Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and morning show co-host.
It was 50 years ago tonight, as this interview airs, that the viewing public of America first caught a glimpse of a program called Star Trek. And little could anyone have known, including those involved in the creation of this series, how it would remain such a potent, vibrant phenomenon half a century later. One of the people who really helped to shape this series is a woman by the name of Dorothy Fontana. At the time, she went by the professional pseudonym of DC Fontana when she wrote for television, in part because so many of the writing that she did involved projects that one might not have thought of, at least in that day and age, as something for which a woman could write. In fact, Dorothy Fontana was a very, very talented writer, and she eventually had the opportunity to show that ability to spectacular fashion, not only in writing for Star Trek, but also serving for a time as its story editor. So playing a very significant role in the reshaping of certain scripts as they crossed her desk. And I am very, very happy to be able to spend a few minutes over the phone today talking with someone at the ground floor in the earliest days of Star Trek's creation. Dorothy Fontana, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
I'm really, really honored to be speaking with you. I wonder if you could just say a word about the sort of circuitous route by which you ultimately got to begin writing for television. I think it is something that you had aspired to do for a long, long time, but this was at a point in time when probably most writers for television, and particularly some of the genres you were interested in, were not typically women. Tell our listeners about the way in which you were able to make this happen for yourself.
Well, I was a production secretary for Samuel A. Peoples at Review Studios, which was located, and they had actually bought the Universal Studios. We were doing a Western series called Overland Trail, which only lasted about 18, 20 episodes, something like that. And then Sam went directly into his Pat Garrett Billy the Kid series, a half-hour Western called The Tall Man. Sam knew that I had written short stories since the time I was 11 years old and wanted to get into the business of writing. I had been in production. He said, if you tell me a good story, I'll buy it. So we watched The Tall Man develop, and I came to him with a story called The Bounty for Billy, and he bought it. It was early 1960, and I was 21 years old.
Amazing.
And after that, I wrote another story. And then I said, I want to do a script. And he said, go ahead. So I did two scripts for The Tall Man. After that, I sold a story to Frontier Circus, which was another show that Sam was producing. And I did a rewrite on a script called for a series called Shotgun Slade, which was a half-hour Western starring Scott Brady. So I was getting work because of my connections within the production, you know, of Review Studios and the series I was working for. And I always tell this story because it still brings a smile to my face. The guest star on the very first story I told to television was a gentleman named Leonard Nimoy.
Wow.
And, so I have known him, or had known him, since 1960.
Incredible.
I went down on the set and we chatted a little bit. He was very nice to a newbie writer. And, of course, we kind of had a relationship later on, you know, on this series called Star Trek.
Yes, that a couple of people have heard of.
Yes.
I read something about your earliest days in Hollywood. You had been stationed, so to speak, in New York City for a while, but then made the move to Los Angeles. And I think one of the first jobs you got in Los Angeles was really as a typist more than anything. And the way I've heard the story told is that as you're typing these scripts for, I don't know, Leave It to Beaver or certain shows, you're thinking to yourself, I think I could do this, and I could maybe do this even better than some of these writers. Is that story true?
Well, not quite, almost, but not quite. Actually, I worked in New York for about 3 months after I graduated from college. I got an associate in arts degree in business from Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey, where I'm from. I saw this job posted in the New York Times, and I went and applied for it. It was at Columbia Pictures, but it was really Screen Gems. And the job was a junior secretary to the head of Screen Gems, Ralph Cohn. And I got the job, and I worked there actually from June through almost the end of July, about 2 months. And then my boss dropped dead. So I figured maybe there's not too much of a, you know, market here for me. I'm going to think about something else. But during the time that I was in Mr. Cohn's office, of course, as the president of Screen Gems, he got copies of all the television scripts for the series they were doing. And as they came across my desk, that's when I started to think, you know, I think I could do this.
And of course,
so it really started in New York. And I worked temporary in New Jersey until September, saved my money for a trip out to Los Angeles. And I told my mother, I'm going out to Los Angeles for a 2-week vacation. I'm going to apply for jobs out there in television. If I don't get them, I'll be home. Otherwise, I get a job and I stay. So she was all right with that, and I got a job within a week after I arrived here at Review Studios. And yes, I was in the steno pool where we were typing scripts, and I love to tell this story too. One of the scripts we were typing was Psycho.
Ooh.
And you know, Robert Bloch's original story. He also did the script, as I recall. I thought it was really cool. And I was asked to take the finished typed pages up to Mr. Hitchcock's office, which I did. And I walked in on a production meeting not knowing, and Mr. Hitchcock was very kind. He just directed me to the person who should be taking these pages. And later on, I became a very good friend of Robert Bloch's because he was a very good friend of Sam Peebles, my boss.
Hmm.
So connections.
It's meant everything, hasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Your involvement with Star Trek began as the secretary to Gene Roddenberry,
production
who, of
secretary.
Course, production secretary. And it was only after the fact, somewhat, that you actually were able to secure your first writing assignment for the series, which is what we all remember you for. Can you just say a word, though, about the kind of work that you did for Gene Roddenberry before that first writing opportunity came your way?
Well, here's the thing. When I was at Metro, I had gone there with Samuel A. Peebles. He was doing a movie. And when he finished writing it, he decided to move on, and I decided to stay. This was in 1963. So it was roughly early summer. And I saw a job on the board. There's that, you know, board that's saying to put up job, and it was for the working as a secretary for the associate producer of a new series called The Lieutenant. I went in and applied, and I was soon working for Del Reisman, who was the associate producer, and Gene Roddenberry was the creator and executive producer of the show. So that's where I met Gene, and I was on the show through the filming of Lieutenant, and along about December, Gene's own secretary was stricken with a bad case of appendicitis and was in the hospital for a month and home recovering. So I worked for Gene because I knew the job, and someone else filled in for me with Dell. And that's how I got to know Gene Roddenberry better. And he found out that I had already written six scripts or stories and scripts. And so I had some kind of track record, and he was okay with that. Then I went back to working for Dell when Gene's secretary came back. But at the end of the show, in spring of 1964, we knew The Lieutenant was going to end, and Gene called me into his office and said, take a look at this, tell me what you think. And he gave me about 10-12 pages of something called Star Trek, and I was impressed with it. It was different. It was the USS Yorktown, it was Captain Robert April, but there was this Martian named Spock that I thought was really interesting. And I said to Gene, when I handed the pages back and told him I really liked it, Who plays Spock? Who do you have in mind for Spock? And he pushed a picture across the desk to me. It was Leonard Nimoy, who had done a role on The Lieutenant for us. So I was happy, and it never was anybody but Leonard Nimoy. I keep repeating this. There have been rumors and legends that other people applied or were tested or were considered. No, never. Always Leonard Nimoy.
Was one of the best things, of course, that ever happened to anybody, that he and that role came together.
Yeah, but it took, you know, two pilots, and finally we got into production on the show. But as a production secretary, executive secretary, I had to type all of Gene's scripts. He usually typed them out rough himself, wrote hand notes, and then I had to put them into proper, you know, script format so that they could go out and be copied. I took care of any appointments, phone calls, you know, the usual office kind of stuff. But Gene was very actively involved on the first 13 episodes, and then Gene L. Kuhn came in as producer. John D.F. Black had left as a story editor. He went over to Universal? He went to another studio to do a movie. And so he and his secretary, Mary, moved on. And Gene L. Kuhn came in. And we had another story editor for a while, about 13 weeks. And he was okay, but he wasn't quite what they wanted. And during that time, Gene Roddenberry said to me, well, I had written Charlie X, because I was one of the first writers. I had written Charlie X. In fact, Gene said, you know the show better than anybody. What story do you want to do? And I picked Charlie X, which is his story, my teleplay. Then I came up with a new story, totally mine, Tomorrow is Yesterday, which was where we go back in time and we pick up a fighter pilot whose son is going to be one of the first men on Mars, so we have to save this guy's life. And then we had lost our second story editor, and Gene said to me, here's the script. It's called This Side of Paradise. It's actually called The Way of the Spores at that time. It became This Side of Paradise. And he said, if you rewrite this to my satisfaction and NBC satisfaction, you're going to be the story editor. So I said, okay. So I did This Side of Paradise. And one of the first things wrong with it was the spores that are the contamination were in this little cave. So if you walked into the cave, you were contaminated, but the easy answer was don't go in the cave. So I had them all over the planet in the plants, which was, you could not escape that. So everybody would be affected. And then the second thing was, it was a love story for Sulu and Leila Kelomi. And I told Gene, this is a love story for Spock. And he said, go write it. So Paradise came out as a script and ultimately as a very much loved episode. And I got the job as story editor, which then meant with working with Roddenberry, Kuhn, you know, Robert Jessman, our production producer. I had to coordinate scripts, I had to rewrite scripts, I had to work with writers, hear pitches with the others, you know, with Roddenberry and Kuhn, and decide who goes and who doesn't, as far as, you know, yes, we buy this one, no, we don't. Story editor is an involving job, but it requires a lot of working with writers, and we had a lot of freelance writers coming in. We didn't have a staff of 10 writers. We had people who came in, pitched ideas. Some of them were asked to come in because they were established science fiction writers. But we worked with a lot of writers. If you look at the credits on the series, you will see there were a good many writers, some of whom repeated, others just did one.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dorothy Fontana about her involvement in Star Trek, the original series, which debuted 50 years ago tonight, on the 8th of September. A couple things come to mind as you mentioned some of these great episodes, which were the means by which you first began writing for this wonderful series. Charlie X, according to Mark Cushman and his wonderful book, These Are the Voyages, in that first volume, says that the idea for Charlie X was Gene Roddenberry's, and he had by that point pretty much discarded it. And you were the one who saw this story and saw its potential. And that brings to mind the fact that one of the most important jobs for anybody working on a series, including especially the story editor, I suppose, is being able to see potential in stories and to figure out that this story is great for this series, this story maybe not so much. Can you just talk about the challenge of seeing potential in a story, even one that's maybe very rough around the edges, but could be potentially transformed into a great Star Trek episode?
Well, Charlie X is not entirely as you put it. Charlie X was in the Bible as one of the examples of the stories we wanted to do. So this was the material that was going out to every writer who came in, you know, wanting to be on Star Trek. When Gene asked me, what do you want to do, because you've known this, you've been with me from the beginning on this, I said, I want to do Charlie X. And so I took his story, expanded it, and then wrote the script. I thought it was brilliantly done on screen. But what attracted me about Charlie X was, here's this kid, abandoned on a planet by accident, being raised by aliens who know nothing about being human. So all he knew was how to protect himself, how to provide for himself, but he didn't know how to be human. And that's one of the themes I like to hit, especially in science fiction stories. How do you become a human? What kind of human being are you? And Charlie had to learn how to be a human being, and ultimately he failed.
Hmm. And according to Mark Cushman, part of what helped you resonate with this was that you had two teenage brothers. And so you could, in a sense, put yourself in the mind of a teenage boy and all that you go through when you're at that age trying to figure out who you are. And, of course, that was the conundrum of this young Charles Evans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one of my brothers was in high school, and the other one was just in the higher grades in grade school. I didn't understand teenagers.
Well, Charlie X, of course, is one of the most effective and dramatic episodes of the series, and it was the second one to air. So a week after The Man Trap, the first episode that aired in that first season, Charlie X was proudly paraded before the public.
Yes.
You had a central role in the crafting of this wonderful episode you've already mentioned called Tomorrow is Yesterday, and one of the things I want to ask you about that is, that was one of the first episodes in that first season in which there is a little heavier dose of some comedy. It isn't a comedy. It's actually a very serious, dramatic episode. But there is this light touch at many moments. And that evidently was maybe also something that you saw as a potential avenue for this series that maybe hadn't been explored all that extensively before that. Do you remember thinking very consciously about that, or did those little subtle comic moments just sort of spring naturally out of the story?
Mostly they came naturally out of the story. I putting myself into the position of our pilot, looking around this spaceship, my God, it's a spaceship, and, you know, it's the future, but what is this machine over here? Oh, it produces food at my request, what's this thing? Transporter? What? You know, it does what? And we are in this day now. I understand there are companies fooling around with transporting small things now, not real human beings, but being able to transport an object from here to there with a transporter, which is kind of interesting. But I just really like the idea of, again, it's a stranger in a strange land kind of situation, and this very intelligent, you know, pilot who's going to be significant to the future is looking around the future, and what does he find? What does he see? How does he understand it? How does he take it? And that, to me, was fun, to put myself in his position and say, what would I do? What would I be looking for? And it was fun to write. It was well done. And I bounced off the naked time, where we were thrown back in time. And, I bounced off John D.F. Black's idea of the time travel and how we get back and all of that, and then put it into Tomorrow is Yesterday.
With brilliant effect, I must say.
Oh, thank you.
You've already mentioned the fact that when Star Trek needed a new story editor, you were handed this script, which needed polishing. And the result ultimately was another great success of the first season, This Side of Paradise.
Well, it needed a major rewrite, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. I want to ask you about the task of rewriting versus the challenge of creating your own story. And, of course, you did that too. There are a number of Star Trek episodes in which it is your story right from the start, which, of course, probably got a little bit of rewriting from others. But there's something else about when you are handed something that already exists and you have to make it better. Can you just say a word about that process, and particularly as the challenges that were involved in doing that for a show like Star Trek? Typically, what kind of things were you often asked to do when it came to the rewriting process?
A lot of times it was the characters just weren't right. What would this character do in this situation? How would he or she respond? Also, a dialogue fairly often could be a problem. I mentioned the two problems on this side of paradise, which was the confining of the spores, which made it not such a great threat. So I came up with a way to fix that. And the fact that it was, as much as I adore George Takei and his character of Sulu, it wasn't the right story for him to have a love affair. It was a Spock story, because under the influence of the spores, we could find out who Spock really was behind that Vulcan exterior, that practically iron exterior of his, and was gone. And now we see who Spock is at heart. And I always want to know what a human being is, how they are, who they are. And this was a great opportunity to do that. And Jill Ireland, who's absolutely gorgeous as Layla Kalomi, wonderful. She bounced off Spock really well. I at the time, because I was story editor on the show, by then the time that we were shooting it, I went to dailies every day, and she was in dailies every day looking to make sure that her performance was up to snuff and that people liked it. And, you know, she's a lovely woman and extremely talented. But the love story had to be Spock. In my mind, it was the only answer. It had to be, to make it an important story. And Ralph Sinensky reminded me that in the original filming, in the original script, it is not indicated that Spock is swinging from a limb, you know, a tree limb or anything like that. We were playing the scene, and they happened to be out in the field, and there was this tree nearby, and Ralph looked at it, the director, and Leonard looked at it, and they both looked at each other and said, let's play with the tree. So that's how the action in that particular sequence came about. I didn't write it that way, but it absolutely works. And again, we see something more of Spock's interior, that he has a playful side, that there is still a bit of a child inside him.
Right. You are responsible for one of the most significant episodes of the second season, Journey to Babel, in which we meet Spock's parents. And his father, who is Vulcan, his mother, who is human. And I believe Mark Cushman, as he is discussing that episode, I think quotes you as referring to yourself as the resident Vulcan expert on the series, or words to that effect. Not that nobody else had knowledge of what Vulcans were all about, but it, in many cases, people would turn to you, and you were responsible for maybe enriching the concept of who Vulcans were and then who Spock was as someone who was both a Vulcan and human. That must have been especially intriguing, a wonderful challenge for any writer to be thinking about an entirely different species and in a sense to have a hand in crafting what that species would represent.
Well, nobody else had been Vulcan, of course, just our Mr. Spock. So we could do anything we wanted. But I was involved with the character. I really loved the character. And by being able to portray him with some of his human side showing in This Side of Paradise, that got me thinking about what else can we do. And we had briefly mentioned, I believe it's at the end of This Side of Paradise, that my father was a Vulcan ambassador. My mother was a school teacher.
Yes.
And that's all I say about them. And that got me thinking, gee, what a combination. Let's think about that for a second. How does that now affect Spock? How does the Vulcan side, you know, meet the human side? Who are those parents? And after the more I thought about it, the more the story started to grow, and I came up with Journey to Babel, where I introduced a whole lot of other aliens, too, but you're most interested in who the Vulcans were. And
yes.
How Sarek would react, and how does Amanda react? How do they relate to each other? How do they relate to Spock? And it was fun to do, but I think I was the person who was most engaged in who is Spock. At the end, I've said this to other people, at the end of the first season, while we were still on stage filming, I went down to the set, and I got time with every one of the key actors. Walter Koenig as Chekhov wasn't involved yet, but I got all the others. Sat them down for at least 20 minutes or half an hour and said, you've been living in this character's skin for a year now. What do you know about them? What have you learned? And they each told me something about how they had been thinking about the characters and what they were bringing to it, what they felt the background of the character was that we hadn't covered yet in any shape or form. We hadn't made any reference. We didn't know that Uhura, for instance, spoke Swahili as well as English as well as she does, et cetera. So I incorporated all these into notes for Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn, And they went over them, and they said, yeah, let's put this in the Bible. This is good information for new writers coming in, and even writers who have written on the show. This is new information for them to absorb and use.
Right.
So it was a good exercise. I did the same thing at the end of the second season. I don't know if it was ever used, but definitely the material that I gathered from our actors at the end of the first season about their characters went into the Bible for everyone's use and understanding. And while Leonard did not say anything about his, quote, parents, I had been thinking about it, and that's where it went into Journey to Babel.
Right. And, of course, that's one great example of how this show was so much more than just the monster of the week and aliens shooting laser guns. I mean, this was also such a powerful, personal kind of drama, unlike anything that had ever been seen on television before, particularly when it came to the genre of science fiction.
Well, here's the thing. Roddenberry first posited it as a sales point, as Wagon Train to the Stars. Wagon Train was a big series then. And as you know, it had Robert Horton and Ward Bond and other people who were the people connected with the Wagon Train. But you weren't so much connected... involved every week with the Wagon Train and where it was going so much as who was in it. And they had incredible guest stars. They had Bette Davis and you know, wonderful, wonderful guest stars. And they told that person's story every week. So it was, in a way, a continuing series, but with a long, strong anthological touch. It was a little bit more of an anthology because it wasn't so much about the journey. It was about the people making the journey. And in a way, we brought that into Star Trek. It's not about the spaceship. It's not about the voyage so much as seeking out new worlds, new civilizations, et cetera. You know, bold to go where no man has gone before.
Right, and what those encounters are going to mean.
Right.
Absolutely.
And these are the stories we wanted to tell. Hiding stories about racism and sexism and political things going on in the Vietnam War, which nobody else could mention, but we did it in the guise of science fiction. And other stories that were important to our time in 1966 and into 1969, but doing the science fiction. And we got the message out. People understood, a lot of people understood what we were saying and doing. And I think part of that made it so strongly attractive to audiences. Hey, they're telling stories nobody else is telling.
Absolutely, and telling them so well. A last quick question.
Sure.
Once Star Trek went off the air, it eventually returns in the form of an animated series, and you had a very strong role, I think, as story editor for that.
Story editor and associate producer, yes.
It must have been so strange, given the budget headaches that Star Trek itself was always facing, and increasingly so as it went on, to be in the realm of animation where suddenly you could place characters anywhere and aliens could be of any sort of outlandish appearance, and you didn't have to worry about, in a sense, the bottom line. There were also other limitations, but I wonder if you could just say a word about what it was like to craft Star Trek episodes in this new format of animation where there were new possibilities not possible before.
Well, obviously, we could tell stories about aliens that were different and more exotic or than we could live action. We didn't have to worry about where the zippers were and things like that. And, of course, great planets, great spaceships, all this other stuff. Our constraints, we did have budgetary constraints because there was a budget, and we did have to pay the actors. The only one we couldn't squeeze in was Walter Koenig as Chekhov, but we did give him an opportunity to write a script, which he did very well.
Oh, yes.
And that began him on his writing career as well as being an actor and later on the director. The one constraint that was important to us is when we were doing the hour show, it was 65-page scripts for 54 minutes of storytelling time. And you could do A, B, and C stories. You know, we'd strong support lines and main action line, main storyline, etc. On a half an hour at that time, you had about 30 pages for 23 minutes of storytelling time. So we really had to cut stories down, keep them tight, keep them moving, keep them interesting, but do it in 23 minutes. And in two acts, a teaser in two acts. So it was a little different from a teaser in four acts, you know, act breaks difference, length difference. Keeping it tight on the storylines, main action line, and maybe a small support B line. So it was a different kind of storytelling. I thought we did it well.
I think so, too.
We were able to do stories that we never would have been able to do on the main one-hour show. And It did win a Humanitas Award in its second season of only six episodes.
Hmm. And at least one Emmy, and deservedly so. And, of course, Star Trek goes on to further life as Star Trek The Next Generation and films and so on.
Yes.
And, Dorothy Fontana, you are responsible for so much of what made Star Trek great.
Thank you.
On behalf of all of us who love this series, we thank you for all you've contributed to the series, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk with you in honor of this great anniversary. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Bye-bye.
You're listening to a special edition of The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are commemorating the 50th anniversary to the day of the network premiere of Star Trek, the original series. In part two of today's program, I'm going to be speaking with Mark Cushman, who did painstaking research over the course of more than two decades by drawing upon unprecedented access he was given to the archives of Gene Roddenberry, Robert Justman, and other creators of the program in order to fashion three remarkable volumes called These Are the Voyages, which tell the true story of the creation of Star Trek better than any previous book. One of your most important missions, I know, is to try to disavow the public of a misunderstanding that has been around for a long, long time, that Star Trek, the original series, was pretty much a complete failure when these episodes first aired. And it was only later, when they went into syndication, into reruns, that people like you and me started catching on to this series and watching it, and fandom arose in ferocious fashion, and the rest is history. That's simply not the way it happened, that Star Trek, even as it originally aired these episodes, was already a phenomenon beyond what we are ever told nowadays. Just say a word about that, about how important this series was, what a big deal it was, even before it sort of went to this next level of popularity.
You know, we who watched it knew that it was very popular. I remember feeling shocked when I looked in TV Guide and they said Star Trek is going to be canceled because not enough people are watching. And I said, how's that possible? Everybody I know watches this. Now, granted, I was at that point 10, 11, 12, 13, And so my peers are people my age, but most houses had one TV set back then. So if the kids are watching it, the family's watching it, and even the older kids, my older sisters and their peers were watching it. That was a real big audience, teenagers and young adults. They were tuning in. So I never believed it. I never believed that this is possible. And each time the network tried to cancel the show, and they tried each season. And then we'd move it to a worse time slot after they were forced to pick it back up. The reason they were forced is because they would receive so much mail, and people even would march on NBC, and it would be organized by local radio stations, and fans would be out there carrying signs saying, don't cancel Star Trek, and be watching, marching on NBC Burbank and NBC Rockefeller Plaza in New York. And Jill Trimble and her gang were marching on the NBC affiliate up in the Bay Area, Oakland. The media had never seen this type of outrage from fans over a show being canceled. So NBC would kind of put their tail between their legs. They would pick the show up for another year, move it to a worse time slot, like they were intentionally trying to kill it. Well, as I went through all the memos, well, first of all, as I acquired the Nielsen ratings, and Jacobs Brown paid for those, like $15,000, to get the ratings for every single episode, they're good. But nobody had ever done that. Everybody just accepted what the network had said, and for almost 50 years we were believing this folklore about the ratings. Now you can see the ratings reports straight from Nielsen for every episode. And the first episode, The Man Trap, which you mentioned earlier, had a 47-point-something share, which was number one in its time slot. Well, 47-something means that almost half the TVs in America that were operating at that moment were tuned to NBC and Star Trek. And you see a lot of these episodes winning their time slots. You see, even if it comes in second, it is a close, close race. And as I said earlier, their top rated Thursday night show, then their top rated Friday night show. So the Friday night episodes didn't get as much ratings, but it still was their best show of the night. No network's going to cancel their top rated show of the night. So why is NBC trying to cancel Star Trek? So as I got deeper and deeper into the memos and everything and putting these memos in the book so everybody could read this and understand this, you see this battle happening between Gene Roddenberry and NBC over the content of Star Trek.
And what kind of stories it should be telling.
Look at like one of the early episodes, The Enemy Within, where Kirk is split by a transporter malfunction, and the bad Kirk tries to rape his yeoman Janice Rand, and pins her to the floor, and is literally, I mean, she's struggling and screaming, and he's throwing her down, and he's climbing on top of her. I mean, you read the memos. I mean, that alone, NBC was saying, you cannot have the star of your TV show trying to rape a woman on our network. And Roddenberry said, well, he's not trying to rape her. He's just being a little pushy. You know, he's coming on a little strong, and that's the way we'll shoot it. Well, anyone who's seen that episode, it goes way beyond that. And NBC said after they viewed it, they were really nervous about putting that on the air, and they said, let's push this way back in the season because this is the first season. We don't want America's first impression of this character to be this animal. And it was the fifth episode to air because Star Trek was behind on the deliveries. They didn't have anything else ready for the network. The photographic effects were taking too long. So this is all we got for you for tonight. And it's winning its time slot for the first 30 minutes. And then the minute that attempted rape takes place, Star Trek drops down to number 3. People were jumping up, parents, mothers were jumping up and switching channels because their kids are watching this show. And so the network came back and said, we will never rerun this episode. Don't ever do this to us again. But he did do it to them again in other ways.
Right.
Time and time again.
It shows kind of the contentiousness of that relationship. And,
oh, yeah.
And in a sense, we can sort of understand both sides of it, although most of us who love the series itself tend to be much more sympathetic to Mr. Roddenberry and those who worked with him on the series. I'm curious, you give us such an amazing amount of information, and you had access to all kinds of files from Mr. Roddenberry, Mr. Justman, and others who were involved in the creation of the show. What, of course, you did not have that kind of access to was memos exchanged between the top brass at NBC, and you were not a fly on the wall for whatever conversations occurred about Star Trek and their attitudes towards it. I mean, we can more than infer their attitudes by so much of what they did. But I wonder if you have any any sense of hunger that you wish that there were file drawers you could pry open somehow and really understand even more more assuredly just what NBC's reaction to this series was.
Yeah, of course, because when you're doing this type of research, you want to find what both sides, both opponents are thinking every step of the way. But fortunately, what we do have, and it is in the books, is those letters from Stan Robertson of NBC, because he was assigned to be the program manager of Star Trek. The network would have numerous program managers, and each of them would have two or three shows that they had to deal with. They were the liaison between the show and the network, and the studio and the network. And so almost on every episode there, you do see a memo from him or a letter from him to Gene Roddenberry and his staff saying, like the ones we just talked about in Enemy Within, that you can't do this. He's supportive of the show. He's trying to work with them. But you can get a sense of the pressure he's under. And, for instance, the episode Plato's Stepchildren, which was the first episode to have an interracial kiss on American television, a white man and a black woman, Kirk and Uhura. And NBC was a very liberal network. They're the ones who had put I Spy on a year before, Star Trek, which was the first instance of a white and a black actor on equal status, and the first time a black actor won an Emmy, Bill Cosby, 3 years in a row for that series. So they were at the forefront of pushing the barriers to put interracial casting onto television. but they still had to think of what their Southern affiliates wanted to see. And would all the affiliates carry the show? Would they get the clearance of most of the stations? And so they had these their own battles to deal with. And yes, it would have been wonderful to have had access to those memos. But just by seeing what Stan Robertson is saying to Gene Roddenberry each week on the next episode they're doing, you get a sense of what he's up against. But they never said with Plato's Stepchildren, you can't have a white actor kissing a black actress. But what they did say is they'd come out and say, well, you can't be forcing this person to do something against his will if it has anything to do with interaction, physical interaction with the opposite sex. So they were objecting to the episode on that boundary, because Kirk and Spock are being forced to do this over mind control. And so the network would object in a very careful way to try to get some of these stories not told. But you can imagine the conversations that were going on behind closed doors about we can't let them do this. Mm. And when you read that episode in particular, they actually came out. The network brass came to the set, and we have numerous conversations with the cast and everybody else about what happened that day and Gene Roddenberry. And they showed up on the set. They're not going to put it in writing, but they sure came out there and said, you're not shooting this scene. And there's an argument, and they shut down production for a couple hours, and Shatner went off to his trailer cursing, and Nichelle Nichols went off to her dressing room very upset, saying this is bullshit and everything else. And finally, Gene Roddenberry said to the NBC guys, we'll shoot the scene two different ways. We'll shoot it where they kiss, and we'll shoot it where they resist the kiss. And they did that, but then you read the story, how William Shatner, they shot the first one, the actual kiss. And now they're out of time. It's the end of the day, and Paramount turns the lights off at 6:20. They'll cut the power because they're refusing to let the show go into overtime. It's costing too much. So they did that one last take where they don't kiss. And what NBC couldn't see is the camera was angled towards Shatner, and he looked into the camera, and he crossed his eyes. So then days later, when the thing's being edited, when the brass comes back into the editing room to have the argument about which take they're going to use, they were forced to use the kiss. Thank you, William Shatner.
We're speaking with Mark Cushman. He is the author of three books called These Are the Voyages, which take us painstakingly through the creation of each and every episode of the Star Trek, the original series program. And there is, of course, a big story of Star Trek beyond those three seasons and the cancellation. And I think this is a story that you are planning on exploring in maybe a new book about where this phenomenon goes from there. And, of course, it's really kind of an amazing story of at sort of a grassroots level of fans of Star Trek coming together in all kinds of spectacular ways. Can you just say a general word about the way in which Star Trek sort of reasserted itself in a way that very few people, including probably those involved in it, had no anticipation would ever happen?
Yeah, when it got canceled finally, and NBC was prepared, when they moved it to Friday nights 10 to 11, the death slot, they got themselves ready to go to war. They got themselves ready to fight the fans again and fight the protest and everything else. They did not want it to be a media event as it had been the year before. So they did a nice little trick, and this will get to your question in a moment. The trick was they took Star Trek off after it broadcast its last new episode of the third season for several weeks and then put it back on the air to do 12 repeats of those episodes, a very small rerun period. And so when the fans started writing in their protest letters, NBC had a mimeographed letter ready to send right back to them, and it's in the book where they just write back and say, don't worry, Star Trek will be returning to the NBC network soon. And so this was their way of making the fans think, oh, it's being renewed for a fourth year. They hired extra switchboard operators. They did everything they had to do because they had been in war with this twice before. And so they were prepared the third time to stand up to the fans, knowing every trick the fans would use, including sneaking into NBC and putting bumper stickers on the executive cars saying, live long. strong and prosper. I love Star Trek and things of that nature. So they really did their homework this time. They were able to get it off the network. But what you'll find out in the fourth book next year is that 2 years later, they wanted it back. And every year after that, they wanted it back. And they kept calling Paramount saying, can we have it back on the air? Well, no, Leonard Nimoy is working on Mission Impossible. He's not available. He's under contract. Things of that nature that were keeping it from getting back. And it finally went into the animated series because that was the third, fourth year NBC had asked for it back. And they said, we can't give it back to you. The reruns are doing too well. We're afraid we'll lose money. Maybe next year. Maybe next year. And finally, they said, well, give us something. And they said, well, how about a half-hour animated version of it with the original cast doing the voices with the original writers, a very adult Saturday morning show, which won an Emmy, by the way. And so it came back that way. And then eventually it came back. They were going to relaunch it as a series, and then they changed their mind, and they did the first motion picture, and it made so much money, they just kept going that way. And eventually we got next Star Trek, The Next Generation. But it's a very interesting and long and winding road as far as how Star Trek came back and how many false starts there were to bring Star Trek back and why they didn't play out. And so when I finished the third book, I was trying to put all that in a final chapter because you can't just end the book on you're canceled. And by the way, they really pulled the rug out from under them because there was supposed to be 26 episodes that third season, and there was only 24. Halfway into filming the 24th episode, NBC said, we're pulling the plug and don't bother shooting the next two episodes, which would have been terrific episodes. One of them was written by Theodore Sturgeon, who had written Buck Time and Shore Leave and was a famous science fiction author. The other one was William Shatner was going to be able to make his directorial debut. So they were crushed because they didn't even get to finish the third season. So it's a fascinating story. And when I saw that I wasn't able to fit everything into a chapter, and the chapter was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, that's when Susan Osborne, who was editing these books, said, why don't you do a fourth book? These are selling well. You know, this is so interesting. This is going to be the best of all four. She told that to me just the other night again, saying she can't wait to start editing my manuscript on this one because she said, I'm really looking forward to this book because she knows some of the stories that I shared with her.
Another facet of this phenomenon is not just that it begat the animated series and then this series of films, but it also has generated an extraordinary amount of fan fiction. And also, of course, plenty of additional fiction that has been, in a sense, more officially sanctioned by the creators of the intellectual property. I mean, properly accredited sequels of all different sorts. And I should think that is in many respects, maybe as much as anything, a mark of just how unprecedented the significance of Star Trek is, because no other television series has ever inspired anything closely resembling that.
Well, first it took off in merchandising, because people were writing in letters, and I was one of them, saying, can I have a tribble? Can I have a phaser? Can I have a tricorder? Can I have a script for one of the episodes, my favorite episode? Can I buy the script? And nobody had ever done that on TV. We'd get our lunch boxes. We might get a model kit. But nobody had ever wanted to read the scripts before and things of that nature. So it really reinvented merchandising for television and where it could go where no merchandising has before. But then, yes, the fan fiction. They were writing these things in fanzines while the show was on the air, writing stories of their own. And Star Trek, unlike most other shows, which is hire professional writers, they brought writers into television writing, aspiring writers who would send in scripts to them and try to get them produced. That happens all the time now with every TV show, but that was rare to be receiving unsolicited scripts from people who are watching the show.
Mark Cushman is the author of this three-volume set called These Are the Voyages, looking back on Star Trek, the original series. My thanks to Mark Cushman and DC Fontana for joining me today for this very special edition of The Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. And it's 8:59 on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert joins us along with Allison Thielen from the Rittpike River Initiative Network. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served